From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C.
I don't see how a person can separate their public life from their private life or from their faith. Our faith informs us in everything we do. My faith informs me about how to take care of the vulnerable, about how to make sure that people have a chance in life.
My religion defines who I am. I've been a practicing Catholic my whole life. It has particularly informed my social doctrine. Catholic social doctrine talks about taking care of those who can't take care of themselves.
This past Thursday night, Paul Ryan and Joe Biden made history. For the first time, two Roman Catholic candidates faced off in a vice presidential debate. Toward the end of the debate, they addressed the issue of religion. And although I was disappointed that most of the time was spent on abortion rights, it was a significant exchange and one that I'd like to talk about today. So later on in today's show, Greg LaBelle will be joining me to do just that.
On October 11, 1962, the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council was opened by Pope John XXIII. More than 2,000 bishops and leading church experts met in four long sessions over 3 years to address modern world challenges. 16 documents were written that continue to guide the course of the church today.
Out of touch, insular, authoritarian, less than relevant. All of these charges and more are being leveled at the Catholic Church, even as it struggles to increase its influence in the United States and elsewhere, and to rein in dissident clergy, women religious, and lay members. But you know what? Much of this isn't new. 50 years ago, many saw the ancient Latin rituals of the church as bordering on the irrelevant as society embarked on the upheaval that would come to characterize the 1960s. One man led the charge to evaluate the church and its role in the world, and he wasn't a revolutionary bent on dissent and schism. No, he was the penultimate leader of the Catholic Church on earth. Pope John XXIII, known by many as the Good Pope. Regardless of what that nickname implies about other pontiffs before and since, the lasting legacy of John XXIII and the Vatican Council he convened in 1962 is undeniable. Now, a new book provides a sweeping historical overview of Vatican II, of the Pope who convened it, and of the impact it's had on the Catholic Church in the subsequent half century. The author of The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint, and The Remaking of the Church, Greg Tobin, will join us later today on State of Belief Radio. But first,
there's a major shift going on across the country when it comes to people who say they identify with a religion.
People who claim no affiliation are the nuns.
I bet you've seen the headlines in the past several days. A new study just out from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life confirms what we've heard previously from the Public Religion Research Institute. A growing number of Americans do not identify with any organized religion. In fact, more Americans than ever before identify themselves as nuns. Now, that's not N-U-N-S, it's N-O-N-E-S. Not the kind of nuns that you might find on a bus, but nuns, the kind of people that you probably won't find in a house of worship. Considering the level of religious rhetoric that continues to permeate our political discourse, these findings are particularly significant in a presidential election year. There is a political side to this and a religious side. And Pew also confirmed that a majority of Americans want to see politics kept out of the pulpit. That is of special interest following Pulpit Freedom Sunday. For some details of the new Pew study titled Nuns on the Rise, we're very fortunate to be joined by Carrie Funk, who is a senior researcher at the Pew Forum on Faith and Public Life and was involved in this very project. Dr. Funk, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you.
Boy, you all have made headlines and raised eyebrows with this new study.
This new Pew Research Center report finds that 1 in 5 adults have no religious affiliation, as you mentioned. This is the continuation of a longer-term trend in the U.S. We've been watching it over time. But what's going on is the pace of change has now quickened over the past 5 years. So we're seeing an increase from 15% saying they're religiously unaffiliated in 2007 to 20% today. A third of adults today under age 30 are religiously unaffiliated. So a lot of the change that we're seeing is coming from the younger generation. And in fact, a lot of the process seems to be stemming from what we call generational replacement, that these younger generations, even if you control for essentially the time of life people are, the current generation, the millennial generation, has a larger percentage that are religiously unaffiliated than the Gen X, than the baby boomers, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Is there also a geographical factor?
Not so much. In terms of the what's actually kind of surprising is that the growth in the unaffiliated is pretty demographically broad-based. We're seeing increases in percentage unaffiliated among both men and women, among people who are college-educated and not college-educated, among all four regions of the country. We do see that the change is concentrated among whites more so than among blacks or Hispanics.
Hmm. Just how far back has the Pew Forum been in gathering data on this population, and how significant are the trends that you see across the timeline?
What the report does is kind of pull together everything that we could that's relevant here. So in some cases, we're using Pew Research Center data that started in the 1980s. In terms of this religiously unaffiliated, we are sticking with the last 5 years because that's when we have the exact same question asked about what is your religion, so that we're really getting an apples-to-apples comparison over time so that we feel it's a kind of a strong measure of whether there's been real change.
It strikes me as someone in the church that part of what's happening here is people saying, look, you're not relevant to my life now. I don't identify with what's going on in the church. I don't find what I used to find here.
These are difficult, I think, and interesting questions to try to tease apart, and I have a couple of things to say about that. One is that in terms of worship attendance, the changes there are not nearly as dramatic as what we see here among religious identity, if you will, or religious mm-hmm. affiliation. So mm-hmm. just ask people, what's your religion? More and more are saying that they have no religion. They're either atheist, agnostic, or they're nothing in particular. But the percentage of people who say they go to church weekly hasn't changed very much. There's been a slight uptake over the past 5 or 10 years in the people who say they never or seldom attend worship services. Mm-hmm. But part of what's going on is that more of those people who infrequently attend worship services are saying that they're religiously unaffiliated. So possibly part of what's going on is how people talk about their religious affiliation lining up more closely with their practices.
I see. I think the Protestant number was 48. And
that's right. Mm-hmm.
Is that the lowest that identification as a Protestant's ever been?
In the Pew Research Center surveys, that's the first time it's significantly below 50%. Uh-huh. So as you may know from political polling, you know, our exact estimates can bounce around. And one of the things we wanted to do is make sure that we didn't call out a number that maybe was going to bounce back and forth. Mm-hmm. So we waited to make sure that this was statistically significant in terms of unlikely to have occurred by chance. Now we seem to be at the below halfway mark.
Well, there's certainly an eye-opening number of Americans who oppose the injection of politics into religion, and as I read it, the injection of religion into politics as well. I wish you would talk about that and tell us if you see a change in those numbers over time as well, or has that just been a pretty solid truth?
Well, you see a really big difference between the unaffiliated and those who have a religious affiliation, or among Christians, either group. You see a pretty big difference in terms of their views about the separation of religion and politics. So let me just call out a few of those.
Okay.
About a third of those who are religiously unaffiliated agree that it's important for a president to have strong religious beliefs. But two-thirds of the general public says that's important. So it's a pretty big difference in terms of what people think is important in a president. You also see the unaffiliated tending to be more strongly against churches and other houses of worship taking social and political stands on issues or endorsing political candidates. Mm-hmm. So you definitely see big differences. The other piece of that is that you also see the unaffiliated more so than the general public tending to say they're uncomfortable when politicians mix religion and politics by doing things like talking about their faith or talking about how religious they are.
Mm-hmm. Some commentators have noted that if current trends continue, that the nuns are well on their way to becoming as important a constituency for Democrats as evangelical Christians are for Republicans. Do you think there's a way to appeal to this group as a whole, politically speaking?
Politically, the results are quite striking. So, yes, you mentioned that the unaffiliated are quite cohesive. They're skewing liberal and skewing Democratic. Mm-hmm. And I think those results about seeing the share of the unaffiliated vote that went for Barack Obama in 2008 essentially being the equal of the share of white evangelical Protestant vote that went for John McCain in 2008. That's a very striking finding.
Yeah.
The piece that I think gives some caution here is that in terms of issue attitudes, in terms of social issues, the unaffiliated are reliably liberal. 7 in 10 say they support abortion being legal in all or most cases. Another 7 in 10 say they favor same-sex marriage, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But on other issues, and in particular on a broader view about the role of government, the unaffiliated closely match the general public. So, for example, if you just ask people, which would you rather have? You know, you can only get the two choices, a smaller government with fewer services or a bigger government with more services. In fact, more people, about 50% of the unaffiliated, say they would rather have that smaller government with fewer services. So, and that actually almost exactly mirrors the general public.
Mm-hmm.
So what that does is kind of give us a little bit of a caution that we can, we can therefore estimate, I guess, what some of the viewpoints will be, but maybe not all viewpoints, and we want to keep an eye on that.
You've been at this quite a while. What most surprised you in this?
I think, I think there's a number of things that are surprising. Just I'll mention two of them. You know, one is to keep in mind that, yes, the unaffiliated are less religious on some measures. They're less likely to attend worship services, but they're not wholly secular. So finding that 68% of the unaffiliated believe in God or a universal spirit is striking. You know, more than half mm-hmm. say they often feel a deep connection with nature and the earth.
Okay, here's the big question. Broadly speaking, can your new report help us predict what might happen on Election Day?
I would say in the survey research world, we're not in the prediction game. We're in the measuring game. So generally speaking, we don't try to predict that way. But I think in terms of what the data show us about 2012 election, we're finding so far pretty consistent findings where about 65% of the unaffiliated who are registered to vote say they would support Obama if the election were held today.
Yeah. I've been speaking with Carrie Funk, senior researcher at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. The Forum's new report titled Nuns on the Rise reveals the growing number of Americans who don't affiliate themselves with any organized religion. The entire report is available online at pewforum.org. Dr. Funk, I can't thank you enough for being with us on State of Belief Radio to help us better understand the study and the implications of the study.
That's my pleasure.
We've got to take a short break now, but still ahead on this week's show, I'll talk about the vice presidential debate and the place religion had in it with George Washington University's Greg LaBelle. And up next, the Roman Catholic Church on the 50th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council. You're going to hear from Greg Tobin, author of the new book, The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint, and The Remaking of the Church. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Today, critics of the Roman Catholic Church are likely to call it out of touch with the modern world in which it functions, slow to react to crisis within and unresponsive to some of the needs expressed by its own membership. It's ironic, then, that exactly 50 years ago, it was some of these same issues that contributed to a global upheaval in the church as Pope John XXIII convened the Second Vatican Council. Present for the council on October 11, 1962 in Rome were four men who succeeded Pope John in the throne of St. Peter, including the one who serves as the Pope today. Now, this three-year gathering had an ambitious agenda, and little remains in the rules and rituals of the church that were not affected in some way by Vatican II. Now, a new comprehensive biography of John 23rd has been released by HarperCollins Books titled The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint, and The Remaking of the Church. And the author, Greg Tobin, joins me right now on State of Belief Radio. Greg, welcome.
Thanks, Father Gaddy. It's great to be here with you today.
The Roman Catholic Church has been instrumental in shaping Western culture, and Vatican II was instrumental in shaping the Roman Catholic Church, and I happen to think shaping the church beyond Roman Catholicism. So let's start with an overview for our listeners. What is a Vatican Council?
A Vatican Council is a major ecclesiastical event, as well as, you point out, an event that can affect, as this one did, people around the world, not only Catholics, but people of all faiths and no faith.
Does it bring together just Roman Catholic cardinals or bishops, or who all's involved?
Yes, a council of the church brings together the bishops of the church from throughout the world. In the case of Vatican II, there were more than 2,500, closer to 3,000 bishops in residence around the world that included the Vatican hierarchy or curia, cardinals, bishops, and archbishops. But they were really from, represented the church, the universal church, in all its local manifestations throughout the entire world.
Mm.
So it was truly a worldwide or universal event.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the tradition in the church from the first council at Nicaea in the early 4th century through 20 other councils. Vatican I was held in the Vatican in 1869 and 70. It was a very abbreviated session, and it was cut short by a war going on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So Vatican II was the first full-fledged council to be held in the church since the Council of Trent, which is of great historical import, and that was in the later 16th century.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
These things don't happen very often.
Boy.
Bringing together all the bishops in the world to focus on issues, theological issues, and issues of practice within the church.
We're going to take a quick break here and be back with Greg Tobin, author of The Good Pope, a new book about John the 23rd and Vatican II. You'll also hear from Greg LaBelle on the vice presidential debate. Just a reminder, there will be more of this conversation, as well as all of the other interviews on this week's show, available online at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Greg Tobin, author of The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint and the Remaking of the Church. I was in Rome. We were out at St. Paul's Beyond the Walls, passed by the vestry, and this person said to me, do you know that it was right in there that Pope John 23rd told the rest of his colleagues that there was going to be an ecumenical council, and they all fell back. They said, when? And he said, next year. And they said, well, we can't do it that soon. This guy had a passion for this. What led Pope John the 23rd to call this council?
It's really my belief that it was the Holy Spirit moving and inspiring this particular man, successor of St. Peter, at this particular time to do this.
Mm-hmm.
He had a history as a historian, as a pastor, as a diplomat. He had a great love for the church, great faith in the church, was a deeply spiritual human being.
Mm-hmm.
So he was sort of the vessel, I think, to carry out this mandate or inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And he did it with alacrity and with a lightness.
Greg, where was the urgency? Did he see one or two issues as being more urgent than others?
I believe he saw the issue of the church's role and position in the world as the primary issue.
Mm-hmm.
That the church was in a defensive posture, that many of its sort of outward practices seemed to be outdated or not really reaching the people. So his idea of aggiornamento or updating was the theme with which he announced the council,
mm-hmm.
and it carried through the entire four sessions of the council, even after his passing in June of 63, after the first session.
How did the Second Vatican Council address those issues? I mean, people got to realize we're talking about 3,000 people. How do you process that? How do you facilitate that?
Yeah, it was a complicated process, but the bishops themselves, when they came together in October of 1962, had been presented with a lot of preparatory material, background information, agendas, and draft documents. And there were sort of competing forces within that group of the hierarchy, those based in Rome who were very traditional, who wanted the council to go in a certain way, that the bishops would read these documents, maybe have a few comments, and more or less approve them and move on. Some European bishops especially, and some from outside the continent of Europe, when they came to Rome, said, you know what, we don't want to do it that way. We want to have full and open discussions on issues such as liturgy, ecumenical relations with other Christian communities. And so they forced the council, and John the 23rd approved this, to stop, to redraft some of the documents and reorder the agenda so that there would be time, a little bit of air, if you will, let into the discussion, and they weren't just going to follow a pro forma mm-hmm. agenda.
Well, it's been 50 years. It's hard to believe that. What do you see as some of the most significant changes that came out of that church council?
There are many, and there are two that I sort of highlight in my mind, at least. One, the liturgical reforms. Now we take it for granted, pretty much, that the Mass is celebrated in the local language and that the people are invited to participate in responses and prayers and singing and as ministers and helpers in the actual Mass itself. And that's mm-hmm. so different than it was prior to the 1960s. And it continues to be refined. For example, the new translation of the Roman Missal in the U.S. mm-hmm. that affects what the prayers the priest says, as well as many of the responses of the people.
Yeah.
That's a direct result of Vatican II.
Yeah.
Another is the church's relations with other Christian communities, with non-Christians, particularly with Jews. The very last document passed by the council and approved by Pope Paul VI was Nostra Aetate, which dealt with the church's relations with those who were outside the Christian community. It was a major step forward and a major change in the attitude, primarily, of the Roman Catholic Church as regards brethren who are, you know, not of our Christian faith. Also, the dialogue among Christian faithful, Catholics, Protestants, Anglicans, and Orthodox, has been carried on for the past 50 years in a very serious way. Some progress has been made, depending on kind of where you're standing or, or sitting and listening to the dialogue or observing what the results are. But these communities are speaking to each other. Some people are very dedicated, very passionate about this particular aspect of relations between between and among Christians. And again, that's a very direct result of the Second Vatican Council.
What do you think Pope John 23rd would say about today's Catholic Church and its relationship with the world today?
I think he would be pleased with many aspects of the Church's relations and position in the world today. Through mass media, the Church is very visible. The teachings of the Church are very widely available. And I think he would see that as great progress. I think he would be saddened and disappointed at the state of religious communities around the world. Membership has declined so rapidly, especially among women religious. And there are now, especially in the United States, issues the Vatican is concerned about. And women religious are, you know, in a difficult position right now. And I think that would trouble him. And he'd want to, you know, really want to bridge that gap.
Yeah.
The decline in the numbers entering the priesthood would also be a grave disappointment to him. And, of course, some of the recent scandals and difficulties, I think, would really break his heart.
Yeah.
The guess is that he would take a very visible, strong, yet humble position as the head of the Church in dealing with all of these things.
My guest is Greg Tobin, author of the new book, The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint and the Remaking of the Church. It's just been released by HarperCollins. Greg Tobin is vice president for university advancement at Seton Hall. He's the author of The Wisdom of St. Patrick, Saints and Sinners, Holy Father, a biography of Pope Benedict XVI, and co-general editor of Religion in America. Greg Tobin, I don't know how you had time to write this book doing all of that, but I'm glad you did, and I thank you for sharing it with us and for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thank you and your audience.
Well, it's time for another quick break, and Greg LaBelle will join me to review the vice presidential debate. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Stay with us. We're brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote.
The words you just heard, you know from listening to this show, are words that I admire, indeed reverence. They are the words of the late John F. Kennedy Jr., the first Roman Catholic candidate for the White House, when he spoke during the 1960 presidential campaign and made an unambiguous statement regarding his commitment to serve all of the American people and to insulate the presidency from his own particular faith convictions. Now, more than 50 years later, that message delivered to the Greater Houston Ministerial Association remains the standard, the gold standard for responsible church-state separation in American government. Sadly, no candidate running today would dare challenge the powerful theocratic forces that have infiltrated our political system in the ensuing half-century. And so, on Thursday night, when two Catholics faced off in the only vice presidential debate of this campaign season, it wasn't a question of whether their faith informs their politics, just how their faith informs their politics. So what did we hear Thursday night? Well, on the line is Greg LaBelle. He's the assistant professor of political management at George Washington University. He is a veteran of several presidential campaigns. He is a good friend. Greg, I am so glad I can talk to you today.
Well, it's good to talk to you, Welton. My calls usually these days are from students wanting to know what I can do about their grades. So it's nice to be able to help in another way.
Well, listen, what stood out for you most prominently when the candidates were asked about how their Catholic faith influences their political lives?
The thing that struck me most is really the basic inconsistency in Paul Ryan's response to the question, because he talked about, I think I can quote him. He said, "My faith informs me about how to take care of the vulnerable." And what we know is that the Ryan budget, which has been at the center, in many ways at the center of at least the economic debate in this campaign, is something that the Catholic Conference of Bishops roundly disapproved of. Yeah. They said that it fails to meet the moral criteria that they've set for care for the poor in this country. And mm-hmm. I think that Paul Ryan, in this context, owes an explanation for how he can be so in line with the Catholic bishops on the issue of abortion and contraception, and so out of line with Catholic teaching on the preferential option for the poor.
Now, Greg, let me ask you for just a second to play fact checker for me. When Vice President Biden responded on the contraception issue, he said that the Catholic Church absolutely did not have to pay for contraception for their employees in their institutions. Is that correct?
My understanding of the proposal that was that the administration put together is that's not quite correct. I think that Catholic hospitals are still required in some sort of way to provide these services. So just talking about payment, I think, doesn't really address the full issue. The president of the Catholic Hospital Association, who had been, a supporter of Obama's health care reform plan, sort of backed off when it came to this, and her argument was that it still required some fairly significant hoops for Catholic hospitals to jump through.
Right. I wish they hadn't focused so narrowly on abortion and contraception, because the issue is much bigger than those two. What would you have liked to hear more of when that subject turned to religion?
The issue of the budget, mm-hmm. And particularly the Ryan budget. I think it would have been much more interesting, much more informative to bring the issue of denominational faith into the context of the budget debate, because there are some significant issues there that are simply not being discussed.
You know, Greg, I would really like to know what these candidates have as a definition for religious freedom, because it is such a slippery term now. That almost anybody can say they're for religious freedom, even if they support government-subsidized religion.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that, you know, religious freedom can be approached from different angles, and I think that Ryan approaches this specifically from the freedom of Catholic hospitals to function in a way that's consistent with Catholic teaching, whereas Biden approaches religious freedom from the opposite, which he says, look, I'm a Catholic, I understand what my church teaches, but as a public figure, I have to recognize and appreciate the religious freedom of non-Catholics, mm-hmm. and people who disagree with these positions. Yeah. And I think they both fall under the rubric of religious freedom, but they're two very different things.
Greg, let's talk politically about it for just a second. Did either vice presidential candidate come out ahead on Thursday night overall?
Well, I think they had two different agendas, so it's a difficult question to answer. I think that Biden went into this in the wake of the first presidential debate. Biden's job was to fire up the base again.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I think he did that. I suspect that the base is energized again after seeing his performance. I think that Ryan's job was different. I think Ryan's job was to appeal to undecided voters, I think particularly to calm their fears about where his positions on a number of issues. So
yeah.
We saw him in some ways playing the calmer, in some ways, participant in the debate. So
yeah.
I think they probably both accomplished, to some extent, what they needed to do. And I think so the question of winners and losers is probably a draw, but they both did what they needed to do.
Well, if there is such a creature as an undecided religious voter, did either candidate help his ticket with those people?
I suspect your premise is a good one. Is there such a thing? I suspect if there is that the way that these issues probably came to a draw. I don't think they were significant enough to drive people one way or the other.
I see.
In the way that they were addressed.
Yeah. Okay. Put on your campaign hat. And
okay.
I'd like you to answer this question from having been a campaign manager in a presidential campaign. What are you going to look for in Tuesday night's presidential debate?
We need to see from the Obama perspective, and I think obviously this is the most interesting and important question. We need to see Barack Obama engaged again, and I think that the intent of this vice presidential debate was to begin to head in that direction. As I said, I think Vice President Biden was successful in energizing the base, getting them excited again. The president needs to then now pick up on that, be much more engaged, much more willing to take Romney on, but do it in a way that isn't overly negative, because we have seen from observing people watching the debates that when either the candidates turns particularly negative, the voters tend to get turned off. So he needs to be assertive without being negative. Romney probably needs to continue to do what he's doing, but I think what Romney's going to face on Tuesday night is the challenge of the two Romneys. What's the real position here? I've seen so many pieces written in the last week asking that question. Is this the Romney of the nomination race, or is this the Romney of the general election? And he's going to have to begin to address those issues if the president is on his game.
My guest is Greg LaBelle, assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, and a man who has been in the trenches working for several presidential campaigns. Thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's great to talk with you, Welton.
Now, before we go, familiarity may breed contempt, as the old saying goes, but we often see that it's unfamiliarity that breeds distrust, fear, and sometimes even hatred. With Islam in the headlines of stories ranging from the Arab Spring to the U.S. presidential elections, from incendiary films and subway ads to hearings on Capitol Hill, never has there been as urgent a need for more familiarity with this faith tradition called Islam. That's why I wanted to make sure you know about a brand new resource from Interfaith Alliance and the Religious Freedom Education Project. It's called What is the Truth About American Muslims? Questions and Answers. You can find that document at interfaithalliance.org. And for additional helpful information on this vital topic, next week on State of Belief Radio, I'll be talking to Julie Harbin, writer and editor for IslamicCommentary.org, a new resource from the Duke University Islamic Studies Center in partnership with other leading scholarly institutions. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com. You can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcast. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. Share your thoughts on this program with your friends. Let them know what you've heard. Do that on the social media. Use Facebook. Use Twitter. If you need contact information, it's available at stateofbelief.com, including our toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. I always encourage you to ask other people to join this conversation. We want as widespread and diverse a conversation as this nation allows, and that's pretty big. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Look, I say that every week.
Would two or three or four or 200 or 300 or 400 of you join Interfaith Alliance this week at interfaithalliance.org? I'm going to be looking to see if you join. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.